Now, you and Christine have been studying where this came from, trying to find the psychology of these people, what the personalities, how the PC police come about. I'm curious, could you give us any insights on your research, what you discovered about people like Smugly Puff and the others at the rally opposing you?
Well, I'll just give some context and then give it over to Christine. But we've actually been studying the full spectrum of political beliefs. So one of my students, Caitlin Burton, has done a very nice thesis trying to detail out the underlying belief structure of the beliefs that range from conservatism to liberalism. And then Christine started studying specifically political correctness, part to see if it existed, because you can actually find out using statistical techniques whether a concept is real, like it's a real concept, if things actually aggregate together. And so one of the things that Christine was actually just trying to test was to see if there was such a thing as political correctness, and then also to determine what it was, how it was related to liberalism and conservatism, and then what the underlying correlates and predictors are, personality traits and that sort of thing. So
I'd love to get the details on that, because all of us are curious where this social justice phenomenon came from, this radicalism from the left.
Mm-hmm. So as Jordan was saying, it is true, like political correctness does exist. That was one of the main findings that we found.
What does that mean?
So political correctness, what we found that it was that it's actually represented by two factors. We have PC egalitarians and PC authoritarians. I'm going to detail those out and then kind of explain how it is that this movement has been generated from that. So the central element to PC egalitarians and PC authoritarians is the trait agreeableness or compassion. So that's how well you're able to empathize with someone or ability to feel for them. But something that's important to know about compassion is that it actually evolved from the mother-child pair bond. So a mother's ability to care for their child with altruistic generosity. So that's where compassion evolved from. And it's useful to remember that when we're extrapolating onto the effects that we're seeing in society in general with this whole PC movement. So then the differentiating elements of PC authoritarianism and PC egalitarianism are, for PC authoritarians, they have a very low verbal cognitive ability. And that's a correlation or effect size of about a 0.4, which is quite high. And then after that, they also have high interpersonal disgust sensitivity. So how we measure that, that's one of the items on the scale would be, if I were to shake your hand, would I feel the need to wash my hands immediately afterwards? Could we share a drink? That type of thing. Often we have in research people, they assume that disgust sensitivity is related to the conservative side of things where individuals who are white men, for example, are racist towards other minorities. But disgust, it's actually the how culture manages to pass on their norms or the rules that we have in order to have a successful, or the rules for the game to play in order to exist in culture, or in order for us to play the game in our society. So we think that, oh, okay, well, so since white men or the patriarchy are the ones in charge, they're the ones who are creating those rules. But that's not necessarily true. If you're existing in a family that's a minorities family, for example, your parents are then creating that culture for you. So for individuals who are PC authoritarians or left-wing authoritarians, they're getting the rules passed down from their parents that are perhaps against white men. So that's how where we get that claim that white racism exists, the opposite.
Interesting. So how much of it is biological and how much of it is kind of based on their parents and their environment?
So personality traits in general, I believe that there's about a 0.8 or 0.5 to 0.6 correlation with them being biological. So, but for things like disgust sensitivity, that is something that's passed down more so from your environment. But then there is also still that biological element to it. So that's PC authoritarians. We also found a correlation with the existence of a mood or anxiety disorder in your either in the person who was filling out the questionnaire or their direct family member. And
if they were a PC authoritarian.
If they're a PC authoritarian, yes. And we used a very high standard for this where they had to have a clinical diagnosis.
Right.
So it wasn't just generally more anxious. They had to have a clinical diagnosis of an anxiety or mood disorder, either in themselves or the parent or a direct family member. So all of that combines to kind of creating this authoritarian type personality, where they have they're very intolerant for nuance or the unknown. They need all rules to be, or things to be, black and white, very clear cut. And then the anxiety or mood disorder creates this kind of general emotional distress for interactions that they have in society.
See, I find that interesting because we always thought of the preacher from Footloose as the authoritarian historically who didn't want to see change, but you're telling me the PC authoritarians are also people who don't want to see change and they want this black and white.
That's correct, yeah. Only, like I said before with the disgust, we always think about they don't want to see change in terms of men, white cis men staying in power. But then when you get disgust on the left side of things, you're seeing this protectiveness for groups that are displaying distress. So
there's been a huge debate in the relevant psychological literature since the end of World War II about whether or not left-wing authoritarianism actually existed. And the people who invented the right-wing authoritarianism concept were part of the Frankfurt School, and they denied the possibility of left-wing authoritarianism pretty much outright. And it's been a tricky concept to nail down, but what seems to be one of the factors that seems to be similar to both the right and the left authoritarians is a pronounced demand for order. And that's part of a personality trait. It's part of conscientiousness. And so, I should make a methodological note too, because your listeners might be interested in knowing how we determined whether political correctness existed. So what you do basically to find out if a concept or a construct, as they're technically known, exists from a psychometric perspective, so that's a science of measurement perspective, is that you collect a very large number of items of attitude and belief, say. And so what we did was we had a small team of people gather several hundred attitude statements or belief statements that seemed to have been associated in the press and in other sources with the broad cloud nomenclature of political correctness. And then you can subject them to a statistical analysis that tells you how they clump together, or even if they do. And if they don't clump together, then there's no central construct. And so that would have been how we would have discovered that political correctness in fact didn't exist, but was just an artifact of the right wing, which is what politically correct people tend to claim. But the two factors that Christine talked about emerged, I would say, perfectly clearly, certainly as clearly as liberalism or conservatism. And so I think the evidence is very strong that it exists, and then as well that it has two factors and that we can predict it with personality. There was other predictors as well. So
the other factor. So that was the PC authoritarian factor. So the PC egalitarian factor that we found, that one was predicted by, first and foremost, whether you had attended a seminar or had an experience communicated to you from someone else that highlighted individual differences or made you more sensitive, that was geared at making you more sensitive towards individual differences. So for example, seminars on sexual harassment and things like that. So that was the first predictor of PC egalitarianism.
So if they were a person who regularly attends these seminars,
or who had been told to attend one through,
more likely to be PC. So the more seminars we introduce in universities, the more we increase students that are kind of these PC radicals.
Exactly. Yes. So then the second predictor from that was high verbal cognitive ability, which I'm going to kind of link into the PC authoritarians in a moment. And then finally, there was also higher trait openness. So what those kind of combine to create, along with that higher compassion of these individuals, is when you get the PC authoritarians who are quite distressed, that are saying that they're quite distressed, what you see then is that the PC egalitarians, their compassion makes them able to relate to that, or to want to protect those who are high in distress, because again, that mother-child type of pair bond. And then what you see is, so they want to protect those, and then their ability to speak much more fluently because of their higher verbal cognitive ability.
Wait, can you give me a real life example of a PC egalitarian? Because we all know what the PC police are.
Mm-hmm.
What's a real tangible example of a PC egalitarian?
Liberal.
Women's studies classic professor.
Women's study, yeah. And it's also more along the lines of, yeah, classic liberal. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I find women's studies professors quite radical. Mine certainly was, but maybe I just experienced different
But
ones.
They're very liberal.
Yeah.
They're very verbal.
Yes.
Right? Very right. Open.
Verbally fluent, yeah.
So not as radical, but they have a higher verbal ability,
Would you say they're better at subverting their ideas into things without being violent, like you see with kind of the PC radicals?
Well, what the they would definitely perhaps pursue that kind of avenue first and foremost. But what happens is that when they see the PC authoritarians wanting to pursue things by censorship or by punitive justice, that's their central way of kind of enacting their goals. When they see, when PC liberals, or sorry, PC egalitarians see them doing this, because of their high verbal ability and higher openness, they create these post hoc justifications for it. And their higher compassion, they feel like, oh, well, this must be right because this individual is displaying this distress is, you know, they're clearly displaying distress, so I need to help them. And what they're saying must be right.
So one of the things we've discussed, because we've been interested in the compassion element, and Christine already laid out the idea that that was associated with maternal behavior, but it's most specifically maternal behavior towards infants. So you can imagine that your infant is never wrong, never. And if your infant is distressed, the distress always signals that you should do something about it. You shouldn't be critical about that, especially if you're dealing with infants that are, say, younger than 9 months. And so this is a transmutation of that attitude onto the political sphere.
That's interesting because a lot of right-wingers get upset, especially right-wingers who are minorities, saying you're treating us with kid gloves. I mean, I know I feel like sometimes I'm being treated with kid gloves by feminists, so it's quite literally.
Yes, gloves. It's quite literally that, yes. And, you know, it's to me, it's a rise of the Freudian Oedipal mother, essentially, who's so overprotective that she destroys the autonomy of her children, which is from a Freudian perspective, and I've seen this a lot in my clinical practice as well. One of the problems that people really have is escaping from their families, right? Because their independence is never fostered. They're kept in a dependent state, and so they're sort of trapped in the mother-infant interaction. And it's a real trouble for human beings because our infants really are dependent and for a very long period of time. And so there's strong wiring and it's associated with maternal behavior. And it really kicks into high gear, for example, if you have a child and you're flooded with chemicals like oxytocin that increase maternal behavior. But basically what's happening is that the political landscape is being viewed through the lens of a hyper-concerned mother for her infants. And the problem with that is that adults aren't infants. That's a big problem. And, you know, minorities aren't infants. And everybody at the bottom of a given hierarchy isn't oppressed. And everybody at the top isn't a predator. You know, it's a radical oversimplification. And it's temperamentally predicated.
Now, I'm curious. I understand the fostering of these PC police. I understand where it's coming from. I mean, I grew up in a culture where we were all given a special snowflake medal for everything we did. We were all told the kind of politically correct theories growing up, but where are right-wing extremists coming from nowadays? How are they coming about?
Sure. Well, as far as we can tell, the right-wing extremists share orderliness with the left-wing extremists, and so that's high disgust sensitivity, but the right-wing extremists are low in agreeableness, and so they're kind of predatory, and so whereas the left-wing extremists are high in agreeableness.
Yeah, so as you said, the differentiating element really is the level of compassion between right-wing authoritarians versus left-wing authoritarians, or at least that seems to be the case from what we've found in this study. So while that core element really is this low verbal low verbal cognitive ability, high orderliness, yes. Yeah, so right-wing authoritarians and left-wing authoritarians, they share this core element, which is that low verbal cognitive ability, low trait openness, and high interpersonal disgust sensitivity.
Does it have to do with IQ? Does the verbal intelligence have to do with IQ at all? Do those correlate?
So in other studies, they have found that, yes, that verbal IQ or IQ in general, lower IQ is correlated with right-wing authoritarianism. We don't currently have a left-wing authoritarianism scale. That's what we're currently working on. The measure that we used for cognitive ability was not IQ. It's cognitive ability just because it was adapted from other IQ measures, but we can't say that it's IQ.
It was vocabulary, basically. It was vocabulary, breadth, and factual knowledge. Eh? It was both of those. Oh yes. So it's a good measure of cognitive ability. So and what it seems to be pointing at is that, you know, you view the world through your temperament. But if you're intelligent, you can modify that. It's more that the predictors are different. So the things that differentiate conservatives and liberals are openness and conscientiousness. So liberals are high in openness, and that's both creativity and interest in ideas. And so they're very interested in playing with ideas. And so they don't, so they're interested in breaking apart categories and putting them back together for creative reasons. And they're also low in conscientiousness, and conscientious people are industrious and orderly. And so this is kind of an underground reason, I think, that liberals are in favor of income redistribution too, because people who are high in conscientiousness make more money because they work harder.
Right.
So all things considered, the temperamental traits that tilt someone towards conservatism also tilt them towards working harder. However, I have to say that liberals are more innovative and entrepreneurial than conservatives. And so the way that the economy seems to work is that liberals, for all intents and purposes, start companies and conservatives run them. So both, each group needs the other group desperately. You know, and so that's also why you want a continual dialogue between the two sides of the distribution. But the politically correct types, they don't quite fit into that category, especially the authoritarians, because it's not openness and conscientiousness precisely. It's more trait agreeableness. So,
yeah. To go back, because there's a little bit more detail that I wanted to add with the relative level of compassion being the differentiating feature. So while we said again that compassion is evolved from the mother-child pair bond, when you're low in compassion, that means that you have a stronger affinity for the individuals who are at the top of a hierarchy. So it's very much about being strategic. And so any relationships that you form with people are purely out of strategy for you to climb your way up to the top or stay at the top. So that's where you see, for example, in Nazism, how you had this one pure race. And also because you're low in compassion, you're willing to demolish anyone else who does not exist in that race or who's not part of that group. Whereas those who are high in compassion, which is where you get the left-wing authoritarianism from, they like to commiserate with those who are at the bottom of the hierarchy, so those who are oppressed. And because of their also relatively higher level of compassion, anyone who deviates from the norm or from that group who's oppressed, they're going to try and include them, but force them to all be the same. So that's where we get the features of left-wing authoritarianism that we see more in communism.
Yeah, so we've been hypothesizing that the right-wing authoritarians want to bring about homogeneity by exclusion, and the left-wing authoritarians want to bring about homogeneity by inclusion. But they both want to bring about homogeneity. So on the right, that would be more couched in terms of purity, and on the left, it would be couched more in terms of equality. So, but part of it is that you can't collapse your political landscape into a single set of values. You know, now the social justice warriors might say that about free speech, but free speech is actually not a value, I wouldn't say. Protecting free speech is protecting the mechanism by which societies stay stabilized and dynamic. So it's not a value per se, it's recognition of the importance of a mechanism. But then there are different values. You know, one value might be accomplishment, another value might be achievement, another value might be hard work, another value might be equality. And fine, those are all useful values, but there has to be a continual dialogue between all of those values so that the whole value structure, which has to be diverse, doesn't collapse into a single dimension. Because then what you have is one tool for every problem. And that's not good, because the same tool can't solve every problem. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason I think that this is partly why I'm no fan of ideologues, is that an ideological stance gives you a solution to every problem without ever being able to solve the problem, or maybe not even to articulate it properly.
If you enjoyed that video, make sure to subscribe to The Rebel Media for more and to hit that like button.